So great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. The pandemic has really shown the spotlight on our education system. And our next guest thinks it's the perfect time to rethink how we've been teaching our kids. Erica Halverson is with us, professor and researcher at the UW-Madison School of Education, where she developed the Artist-in-Resident program. It's a very scientific name to the program. It's called Whoopersnocker. And she's, we'll talk with her about that for sure. But she's also written a new book. It's called How the Arts Can Save Education. And we're going to talk with her about that book and what she thinks. And I want to know, what do you think? Do you think we should rethink how we teach in our schools? Have the arts helped you in other unrelated areas of your life? Love to hear experiences there. We'd like to have you part of that conversation. And it's easy to do. Just join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Erica Halverson, welcome. Good to see your face again.
It's great to see your face too, Larry. It's, you know, even though we're on radio, at least you and I get a chance to, look at each other while we talk. Exactly.
Erica and I worked a few years back now on a project that I really got a big kick out of, and it was her idea, and she did a great job of it, working with some freshmen here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But and so we were doing a little educating there, or trying to. But I'm wondering, Erica, what are some of the major problems now with how our children are taught, in your mind?
So, you started the segment by saying that the pandemic has kind of revealed these persistent inequities that, you know, we know exist, are discussed frequently. We have a lot of different language for talking about it. We've talked about the achievement gap. So more recently, we talk about the opportunity gap. I have in the book a brief history of how we got to the place that we've gotten to in terms of how we talk about accountability systems in schools, and how those have become the driving force in how we think about teaching and learning. And the argument in the book is that's the wrong way to think about it, that we're leading with the tail, right? We're leading by saying, here's all the things that we think kids are missing, and how can we design our systems to catch kids up, to help them fill in the gaps of all the things that are wrong? And what we know from years of research, and colleagues here at the UW, folks like the great Gloria Ladson-Billings, have talked for years about how starting with what kids are missing rather than starting with what kids bring is never going to get us to a place of equity, because kids of privilege are always going to bring more of what is valued in schools to the table when they start their education. And by not acknowledging the range of assets, the range of skills, the kinds of joy, the kinds of artistic brilliance that all of our kids are bringing to schools, we're never going to get to a place where everyone sees school as the opportunity to become more productive humans. And so the argument in the book is actually quite simple, which is, if we start with what the assets, the social, the cultural, the historical assets that kids are bringing into learning, and we frame their learning in terms of the arts practices that we know result in complex, rich, and robust representations of learning, then all kids stand a better chance of being what we would call successful learners, successfully educated citizens, and productive humans.
Starting with the assets, how do we, I mean, what, How do we measure those assets?
Well, that's a great question, right? So rethinking what counts as learning requires rethinking what counts as measures. And I also talk in the book about how arts practices can show the way for rethinking how we measure what good learning looks like. So an example that's probably quite familiar to you and is familiar to me as an artist is critique. The art of critique is itself an assessment practice. And so one of the things that we do in all of our arts-based learning environments is we teach kids how to critique their own work, how to critique one another's work, and how to understand the ways in which critique makes your own work better. You're absolutely right that rethinking how we do learning requires rethinking how we do measuring.
Okay. You say in your book, in my world, we're not teaching and learning the arts. The arts are teaching and learning. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote it, so I hope that it's a good way to put it. And dive into that a little bit more, you know, I think we have a pretty long tradition in education and in the arts of what we would call arts integration, which is taking arts practices and placing them into already existing teaching and learning systems, right? So you might be familiar with the idea that, hey, kids who are better at art might like science better if there's a decorative component to the science project that they're making. Or you might have heard there have been some studies that have shown that kids who learn to read music do marginally better on mathematics exams than kids who don't learn to read music. And all of those are useful, but they're really tinkering around the edges, right? They're really keeping in place the systems and the values that we currently hold and saying what I kind of jokingly refer to as the put a bird on it phenomenon of arts integration, which is a reference to a sketch comedy show, Portlandia, that I love, that I don't know if anybody else is familiar with, but there's a famous sketch in Portlandia where they have this kind of reclaimed shop. And the joke is, oh, you have a skirt? Just put a bird on it. Then it's a new skirt. You have a purse? Put a bird on it. And so that sort of form of arts integration is what I would call kind of putting a bird on it, right? It makes it aesthetic, but doesn't fundamentally change how we think about teaching or learning. And so by saying the arts are teaching and learning, I'm referring to the core practices. For example, I have a chapter in the book that talks about teaching as improvisation. And I go pretty deep into the theories of improvisational arts, theater, music, dance, and the features of improvisation that I think ought to change the way we do teaching regardless of the subject. And to give you a specific example, because I know that probably sounds a little scary to people that you have to be a, you know, expert improviser to be an expert teacher. The big takeaway that I have learned from years of doing improv is that scaffolding people to take risks is the single most important component of a successful learning environment, and that we can't learn anything and we can't teach anything if we're not willing to take a risk. And by that, I mean contribute our own ideas, possibly be wrong, take up someone else's idea and work with them in a collaborative fashion. All of these moves are about risk-taking. And teachers have the responsibility of setting the conditions for making risk-taking happen. And improvisation shows the way for how educators can be set up to scaffold risk-taking in their learning environments.
I want to hear some more about that. I was thinking about it in relation to the classes I teach, and I'm also wondering about, I'm thinking improvisation with first graders or second graders.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. See, now we got to find out some more about that. Erica Halverson is our guest today. She'll be with us right up until 12:30, as a matter of fact. She's got a great new book out. It's called How the Arts Can Save Education. And certainly talk with her some more about that book. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments, or maybe your own experiences with the arts and other aspects and how it may have affected other aspects of your life. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here. We'll be back right after this quick look at the news. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, can using the arts teach help save education? We're talking about that with our guest today, Erica Halverson. Erica is a professor and researcher with the UW-Madison School of Education. She has a new book out. It's called How the Arts Can Save Education. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Do you think we need to rethink how we teach our children? Have the arts helped you maybe in some unrelated areas of your life? We'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And someone wondered, when we say the arts, and you've talked a bit about some of it, but maybe expand on it. What art forms are you all referring to?
So I aim to be inclusive of all art forms. Right. So I mean the performing arts. I mean the visual arts. I mean the design and digital media arts. All disciplines where making things is at the center of what it means to know and do. And making things can be literally making things, right? A clay pot or a painting, or it can be something ephemeral, like a performance, or, you know, a short film is kind of an in-between, right? The performance of the film is ephemeral, but the film itself is an artifact that lives on beyond the life of the performance. But what I mean to center are the kinds of practices where the goal is to produce something for some kind of audience.
And so how does, here's another question. How does perform, that somebody asked here, how does performing or using the arts make me a better math person?
Make you a better, so I would push back a little bit and ask, make you a better math student? Make you a better mathematician? Make you a better doer of math in your everyday life? I mean, to me, it pushes back a little bit the question of what do we mean by, in this example, being successful at math? But that's a bit of a cheat answer, but I will kind of put that out there. And then the other answer that I'll give is to say that one of the core insights that we get from art making is that the hard work of making art is creating representations. And what I mean by that, right, is having an idea and then using the tools of a particular artistic medium to wrestle with how do those tools allow you to express that difficult idea in a way that's accessible to you as the learner and to others or the people with whom you want to communicate. And that core insight about the power of representations is true of all disciplines. Mathematics is a fundamentally representational domain, right? We've reduced it sometimes to like making sure you know your times tables and passing a geometry test. But the real work of mathematics is representational. And so my the general argument that I'm making is we can learn how to learn better in any representational domain by learning from the way arts practices teach us to be representational. That's my real answer.
And that's a good answer, too. That's a very good answer. Lynn and Racine, let's give Lynn a chance to join in. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. Good morning. I am just so delighted to hear this program. I'm a retired teacher. I taught at a fine arts elementary in Racine for 18 years. I taught music, but there was also dance, drama, and art. So the students got eight art classes a week. And in addition, there were performance groups for the older kids. I know that there are some direct relationships between dancing in circles on the stage and understanding geometry. I know that. I know that there are some direct relationships between dividing measures of music and math. However, the most intriguing to me is the idea of creativity through improvisation, creating something new, which is what you need to do if you are a scientist trying to find the cure for COVID or trying to find a vaccine for COVID or for cancer. You have to create something new. And if you've learned from childhood on to create, then your mind is in a position to create as a scientist, a mathematician, a politician, or whatever.
Lynn, thank you so much. Comment,
is amen,
Erica.
An appropriate response to that comment?
Yeah.
I mean, amen, right? I think, you know, we get used to the idea, and my own high schooler is in this place, the used to the idea that the purpose of school is to demonstrate what you know, to get the grade, to move on to the next thing, to be able to get that stamp of approval. But what your guest is describing is a whole different purpose for schooling, which is to set yourself up for a life of answering new questions, to be a person who can go in the world and say, oh, the task here is to solve a problem that hasn't already been solved. Great. I have some tools in my toolbox that can help me to do that. So I couldn't agree more that setting young people up to become creative doers is a hugely important task of school and something that arts practices show the way for how to do.
And should, from the sound of it, I mean, it sounds like this should be something you feel should start right away in a child's education.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it may look different at 4 than it does at 24. Although there are probably some practices that look quite the same. I mean, fear of trying new things is not something that gets easier as you get older. And so as educators, we always have to set up the scene, to not overuse the arts metaphor, set the scene for people to be willing to try something new, regardless of how old they are.
Lynn, thank you again. I really appreciate your comments. Let's take a call from Elizabeth in Ellison Bay. Elizabeth, thank you for calling.
Hi there. I love this conversation. I have two things come to mind when I'm listening to you, and the other gal just brought it up. I have 5 adult children now, and mine were homeschooled. greatly driven by the topic of this conversation, the creativity, right? The learning how to do things and be able to utterly apply your creative process. I do get very frustrated with the idea that that is limited to what we think about with media, to theater or to singing or to paint, right? Because some of my children use electricity as their creative media. Mm. Or I've got one who's got a patent for some new equipment that he's engineered. That's creative, right? I've got another one who's a painter and a photographer. That's also creative. All of it. I love that. But you said one thing that kind of, you know, when you're talking about improv, we're really lucky. We have the Sills family up here in Door County, and our children were heavily exposed to improvisational teaching. And one thing that Carol really hammered through my mommy brain that was really contaminated with my own background was that it's not about what you're making. It's not about your end product. For kids, it is absolutely about the process. The creative process is what's driving us. And really, the end product, children get really frustrated if they look at their end product and it doesn't meet their imagination, if that's what they think it was about. So the idea is the experience of being in a creative space is what we're really driving at with improv. So I'd love to hear your response.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Comment, Erica.
Yeah, I think I appreciate that, Elizabeth, so much, because we haven't really gotten to that part of the conversation about this cyclical relationship between process and product, and how any robust learning environment has to consider the relationship between those two. In the book, I talk about a design process for learning environments that take an arts-based perspective. And I talk about a cycle of conceiving, representing, and sharing ideas. And what I mean by that is that any robust learning environment has to start with a process of thinking about what is the thing that I want to represent, right? In my world, I'm primarily a theater artist. So I tend to think about that narratively. What is the story I want to tell? But you're so right that, you know, making things at the intersection of technology and engineering and creative practice and visual arts, that is also a process of conceptualizing. And then the determining of the relationship between the tools of whatever medium or media that you're working in and wrestling with how those tools allow you to communicate this idea or this core concept with an eye toward sharing that with some outside audience. And I don't want to overemphasize that as a product as much as I want to emphasize the importance of the relationship between the maker and the audience. Because one of the things that we struggle with in schools, I think, is the abstract nature of how you tell people what you know. Like, who are you? What is the purpose of sharing that? So that the teacher knows that you're like a good girl, which is what a conversation I often have with my daughter, right? Is that the purpose of doing well on an exam? You know, but if you're making, for example, some sort of innovative electric dog bowl feeder because you're not home all day and you want to be able to have your dog be fed on some sort of regular schedule, there's an audience for that that allows you to communicate what you know in a way that honors process and honors the value of your contribution.
Mm. Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling. Suzanne in Madison, give you a chance. Hi, Suzanne.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'll try to make this fast. I taught middle school fine arts program for 9 years in a couple of different cities. And the thing that we did is that I loved the most is we wrote our own musical comedies. Mm-hmm. And all the middle school students would brainstorm plots, then vote on the plots, then brainstorm characters, then write dialogue for the characters, and I would take everything that they wrote and plug it into a document, and then I would fill in the blanks, and we would come up with the best stories, and then we would use pre-existing music. And every student had to act, sing, dance, do scenery, work in the production areas, like making, what do you call those? Not invitations, but whatever you call those things. But it was a thrill. And the biggest thrill of all was the kids would start out, a fair number of kids would start out, I cannot sing, I cannot dance, I cannot draw, I cannot act. Every student would have to have at least two lines to speak to the audience when we put on a production. And I would say to those kids, you understand that genius level thinking includes flexibility, and you're just beginning your life. So please be flexible to the best of your ability, and we'll work with you. And at the end of this, you'll be steps ahead of other people who have not performed publicly. And it was just, there was nothing that I ever did that I think was more thrilling than productions.
Yeah. That's a nice story, a great story, Suzanne. Erica, comments?
Well, it actually makes me think of two things. The first is the corollary that I would add, which is that not only does that kind of arts practice encourage kids to stretch themselves into spaces that, where they don't think they can be successful, but in my own artist in residence work with Whoop and Soccer in Madison and in other places, consistently, the kids who jump out as stars in this program are almost always kids who teachers will say, that kid? That kid hasn't done anything I've asked the whole year. Or I didn't even know that kid could speak because they're so reticent to participate in school-based activities. But that offering other ways of successfully participating in school-based spaces opens up who gets to be called a good student and who gets to be called a successful learner, because these modalities, these ways of interacting, are fundamentally different than the typical modes that we ask kids to participate in. So I kind of want to improv it and yes and the caller and say yes to opening up multiple pathways for kids who are already participating successfully in school, and yes to offering sunlight to the kids who already, maybe by third grade, second grade, feel like they're not good at school.
Craig emailed, he is part of a study on the effects of the arts with kids in an after-school setting of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Green Bay. They've learned significant insights on 21st century job skills that are tied to the arts. Can you speak to that? Also, how can we continue these kinds of discussions?
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're starting to get beyond what I would call the instrumentalized argument of the value of the arts, which was a sort of need in the research community to find direct correlations between some arts practice and some standardized test outcome that we thought we needed to improve in order to call ourselves better educators, right? That was kind of round one of this way of thinking about the role of the arts. And we've now, I think, moved on to a more sophisticated understanding, like they're doing in Green Bay, which is we're not looking to improve kids' math test scores, but we are looking to see whether kids are somehow productively different after they have an arts-based experience, and how can we translate that into, you know, measures that we might care about, like job readiness, like 21st century skills. And all of that research, I think, is so important for building a sense of arts learning as what I would call a learning ecology. So rather than just locating this only in the schools, which puts a lot of pressure on classrooms and asks an already confined and constrained and challenging space to do more, but instead opens it up to say, well, arts learning is also happening in after-school programs. It's also happening in these Boys and Girls Clubs. It's also happening in homeschool settings, like one of your callers said. It's also happening in fine arts magnet schools. How can we look at that whole ecology of teaching and learning and understand what the arts is doing for kids as learners more broadly conceived? How do we keep the conversation going? At the risk of sounding like I'm selling something, that's why I wrote this book, right? I wrote this book to be a conversation piece for artists and educators and community leaders and teachers and principals to have a conversation using the ideas in the book as a way to talk about how can we take collective action in a way that changes what we do as teachers and as learners.
How long do you think it will take to switch this?
That is a great question. I think I would make a terrible politician, because if you're asking how long will it take for sort of a policy shift to take hold, that I can't say. But I think given the huge changes that are afoot in public schooling over the last 2 years, this is an opportunity. Like, now is a time for district leaders and Boys and Girls Club directors and people like me who train the next generation of classroom teachers and library directors to come together and make a decision to do differently. So it could be as soon as 2 years, if there is enough energy in a given place around this conversation.
Well, the whole COVID business was certainly a mind-blowing and mind-expanding experience for most of us in teaching, having to rethink your whole teaching process in about a week's time. And so why not? Erica, it's been fun talking to you. And, when we first met, worked together, I think you were pregnant at the time.
That was a long time ago.
So good to hear you've got a daughter who's doing well. And I hope your book does well, too. Maybe we can talk about this again. I hope you'll join us at another time. We'd love to speak with you.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Erica Halverson, our guest, and her book. I hope you'll have a chance to take a look at her book. And I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network, her book, How the Arts Can Save Education. There's the title. Stay with us.